This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Donvan in Washington. Neil Conan is away. 2,260 words. That is the reading length of Google's privacy policy. Sure, you've read it. Well, probably not for most of us. Even with all of the notice that was given in the past month that today Google changed its own policy, changed it so that now the company has even more powerful ways of knowing what you do on the internet, who your friends are, what you like to buy, and where and when and how much. Google is the company that claims to follow the motto, don't be evil. And this privacy rules change is meant to create, the company says, quote, a beautifully simple, intuitive user experience across Google. So, whew, it's okay. Or maybe not, say a number of critics who see the new policy digging deeper into users' lives in ways that may not do only good. What do you want to know about how much Google knows about you? And frankly, how much do you care? Tell us your story. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. What do you want to know about how much Google knows about you and how much do you care about it? Later in the program, Alan Locos joins us on how to harness patience. But first, Steve Henn joins us. He is technology correspondent for NPR and joins us from Menlo Park, California. Steve, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure thing.
So what exactly is the rule change? How big is it?
Well, until today, Google had more than 70 separate privacy policies. So they had been writing privacy policies for pretty much each of their services. They're consolidating more than 60 of them into one sort of umbrella privacy policy. And for many of the services, that won't really change what they do with your information. But for a couple of them, it will allow Google to share more information that it collects internally. So, for example, they'll be able to use information they collect about your search history when you're signed into a Google account and use it to target advertisings or create new services in other services they create, say on Gmail or on YouTube. So there are two main services that are affected that will be sharing more information more broadly, and those are YouTube and search.
So in a way, search can talk about you to YouTube, and YouTube can talk to search about you and what you like and where you go and how you spend money and what you're looking for, more than it used to be able to do.
That's right. And they'll share that information with Google Circles or their social network, Google Plus, or Gmail or Google Maps or Google Docs. So sort of across the wide range of things Google does, they'll have one profile about you as a signed-in user that will collect and share all of the information that they know about you as you interact with all the things they do.
And when we talk about information, what nature of information?
Well, so this only affects users who have signed into a Google account. So if you have a Gmail account and you sign into that account, you'll notice after that, when you go to the sort of Google search page website, that you're signed into Google. Your name will actually appear in the upper left-hand corner. Mm-hmm. And basically, what they're doing is collecting a lot of information about what you're doing. So if you're in Gmail, Gmail automatically reads your emails and
the content.
You mean it goes inside the email?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a human being isn't doing that, but a computer algorithm is doing that and targeting ads based on the words you use.
And that is not new. We've been living with that Gmail reality for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And there's also a Gmail chat system that allows you to talk to friends, sort of like Skype, and there's an archive of who you've talked to. Now, they could take that archive of who you're chatting with and use it in new ways to perhaps recommend videos on YouTube that that your friends liked who you were chatting with. So, you know, across the range of products and services that Google offers, this will give them a lot more leverage to take all of the information they know about you,
right,
and use it to sell ads to advertisers.
And that is the primary purpose of gathering this information? Because Google says they also gather the information in order to improve their product and make things flow better and also to look for security holes and all kinds of things like that. But the bottom line is the bottom line, that it helps them target ads?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that this was largely a business-driven decision. You know, Google's facing a lot of competition in the online advertising space from Facebook, which has sort of this collection of social information about its users that advertisers find very attractive. So Google's trying to replicate that. But I think there is also a lot of truth to the idea that what they're doing will create them to create new, interesting, powerful services that people might like. So one example that they gave right when they first announced this change was the idea that they would be able to use your location if you were signed in to Google on your mobile phone and use traffic information that they collect through their Google Maps system and let you know if, because of a traffic jam in your neighborhood, you were in danger of being late for an appointment that appeared on your Google calendar.
I see.
So it's basically about creating mashups like that that anticipate users' needs and can, in many ways, you know, I think many people would find them delightful. But, you know, Google is a business, and if they're able to anticipate users' needs, advertisers will also find that delightful.
And what assurances, Steve, does Google provide along with the announcement that they're making this change?
Well, you know, one of the things that was reported initially when they said they were making this change was that there was no quote-unquote opt-out. And to a certain extent, that's true. If you sign into a Google service, you have to agree to those terms of service. But you don't necessarily have to sign in to Google to use search or to watch videos on YouTube. So users actually have a fair bit of control over when Google is tracking you and when they aren't. And we can go into that more deeply later. Another major assurance that Google makes is that, except for very limited circumstances, it doesn't share this information it collects with third parties. So it's not building a dossier on all of us and then going out and marketing it or selling it to other actors. This information is being shared internally. And then, of course, Google makes lots of assurances that it will try to keep this information safe and secure. And, you know, obviously Google is an impressive technology company with impressive technical people inside it, but it has had security problems in the past. There have been Google engineers that have abused their access in the past. And I think for any major company, that's going to be something that sort of requires constant vigilance if you have these kinds of data stores in your servers.
All right, Steve, we'd like to ask you to stand by for a little bit. We want to talk to some listeners and get some other views. And I'd like to go first to, and our question to you is, what do you want to know about what Google knows about you? And do you care? Does it concern you at all? Or are you a happy user and you like what the service is going to bring you? Let's go to Mitch in Logan, Utah. Mitch, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have thought lately, and I appreciate your conversation. I remember a blog post, I think it was, by Seth Godin, business thought leader. And his blog post was pretty simple. He says, we all know privacy is gone. We don't have it when we choose to participate on the Internet. The thing he mentions is that we just don't want surprises. And I think that was, for me, that was an interesting way to look at it, with all the tracking.
And what's interesting, Mitch, though, is that this was in no way a surprise from Google. And they did an unprecedented amount of announcing of this with billboards and emailings and all manner of communication. Yep. So you don't feel surprised, it sounds like.
No, I don't. And that's kind of what Seth Godin was saying, was just, you know, let us know.
Yeah.
We know we don't have it. As long as you're up front with us, let us know what's going on. Then basically you can do whatever you want, and as long as we're informed.
Yeah.
So that was interesting to me to think about with all of the tracking.
Mitch, thanks so much for your call, and we got to say, Google let us know on this one. I want to bring in Laurie Andrews. She's a law professor at IIT Chicago Kent Law College of Law, and also author of a book called I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. And she joins us from a studio in Chicago. Laurie, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
So Google changes its policy. So what is the so what in this?
Well, let's say I Gmail a divorce attorney, and then I do a Google search for anxiety, and then I'm watching YouTube with my young son, and ads come up related to divorce and mental illness and so forth. It reveals things in context you might not want. Fundamentally at heart, Google is an advertising company. It makes 96% of its income, 3.6 $36.5 billion a year on advertising. And sometimes that can be great benefits. If Google knows more about me, it can tell me how I can get money off at a store I like or where my favorite band is playing. But it can also further problematic things. They admitted in 2010 that on the Google suicide chat room, when young people said, I'm going to commit suicide using X chemical, an ad would immediately pop up that said, call 1-800 blah, blah, blah now, 2-for-1 that chemical. Or it may be that I Google search something like guitars. And then later I'll go to a credit card website. Well, that information that I'm interested in guitars lumps me into a category of guitar players. And if guitar players are more likely not to pay off their credit card bills, when I go to a credit card site, the ad I will be shown will show a lower limit than, say, someone who searched for skiing. And so that's going on, you know, in milliseconds, judgments are being made about us based on what we search and what we post.
So in other words, you're saying that there's a algorithm out there creating a narrative about us based on this data, actually creates a sort of story about us, then makes decisions.
Yeah, a digital doppelganger.
And that the presentation of advertisements actually has consequences in the real world because it sounds harmless. An ad's going to pop up, so what?
Yeah, and no, but it can be used in other ways to make decisions about you, and that has happened in life insurance. Mm-hmm. And so I may have searched for a particular illness, and I might have done it for a mother or for a mystery book I'm writing, and yet that's thought to be actually about me and will affect what happens when I go to a life insurance site. And we're seeing that more and more are online selves are mattering more than our offline selves. 75% of companies now require that their HR officials check your social network presence, your Google Plus page.
Laurie, let me put you on standby for just a second as we take a break and we'll come back. Laurie Andrews is a law professor at IIT Chicago Kent College of Law. We're talking about data mining and Google's new privacy policy. I'm John Donvan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm John Donvan. Google rolled out major changes to its privacy policy today in what they say is an effort to streamline things across their products and allow them to build a better, more intuitive user experience. We're going to hear more about that directly from Google in just a few minutes. But users are worried about the Internet giant learning too much about what they can do on the web. And we're talking to Laurie Anderson at IIT Chicago Kent College of Law about that. And one more question to this point, Laurie, is that Google, number one, issued an extensive prior warning about all of this. And number two, really makes the point that they're going to do everything they can to protect privacy and to make adjustments to these things. What do you feel, make adjustments to these things to prevent the kinds of unfortunate outcomes that you were talking about before the break? How do you feel about that commitment that they make?
Well, there are two principles at play. One is privacy, but the other is consent. And Google's getting into trouble in Europe right now under their particular data protection policies. Your last caller said, hey, I don't care that they're running over my privacy because they told me. Well, that think about it in terms of other constitutional rights we had. What if a company said, we'll only do business with you if you give up your right to vote or you give up your right to reproduce children? We wouldn't say, oh, it's fine. They told us about it. In addition, Google's actions might violate their agreement with the Federal Trade Commission in terms of not getting consent of people before making these major changes.
Don't we all have the right just not to use Google? To stay out of Google land?
Well, increasingly, we don't. For example, I'm at a university, mm-hmm. and they've moved over to Gmail for our university account. I have no choice about that. And I think that, you know, I'm in Chicago. The mayor is closing libraries on Mondays. Kids are using Google Wikipedia to do their research. And, you know, think about if the government had tried to get this private information from Google Plus and so forth and asked us directly, would you tell us, you know, your political interest and what you watch on TV and your GPS location, because Google says on Android phones it will continue to collect location even if you've turned your GPS off. If the government tried to get it, as one security analyst, Richard Powers, says, it would have taken money, it would have taken lawyers, it might have even taken guns. And yet we're giving it up to Google, and 93% of the time when the government asks them for our information, they cough it up. And that's by a Google's own report.
Laurie Andrews, I want to thank you very much for joining us and raising these concerns, and welcome you back the next time we touch on this topic. We're going to say goodbye to you now and thank you and move on to listeners. But thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So we've asked you what you want to know about what Google knows about you and whether you really care and what your concerns are. And Steve Henn is joining us again. He's NPR's technology correspondent out in Silicon Valley. And we want to go first, also not far from you, Steve, to Oakland, California, where Philip is joining us on Talk of the Nation. Hi, Philip.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. My question is this. I heard Google announce that there was something called desktop or something like that, that name?
Dashboard, I think.
Dashboard. Where you could go there and you could opt out. And I want to know, to what extent can you opt out, or do I have that description wrong? Is it something you can...
What about that, Stephen?
Are they lying, or what are they telling us?
No. If our listeners haven't gone to their Google dashboard, I'd recommend it. You can just Google or Bing Google dashboard, and you'll have to sign into your Google account. So if you have a Gmail sign in or a Google Plus sign in, you'll need to sign in, and then in one place you'll be able to see an outline of all of the different Google accounts that are associated with your identity and links to help you manage those accounts. Probably the most interesting one, I think, and one of the most relevant considering the changes today, is something called web history, which is a combination of your search and browsing history online. And this is only the history of what you've done while you're signed into a Google account. But in my case, I opened it up a couple days ago for the first time. And I had a search history dating back through May of 2010 that was actually attached to my identity, and it had thousands and thousands of searches. You have the option to delete that entirely. You have the option to delete individual searches, and you can also turn it off. You can hit a button that says pause search history, and that will stop sort of the accumulation of searches that are tied to your identity. There are other things you can do with search to search anonymously. You can simply sign out of your Google account and search that way, or you can use a browser in an anonymous mode.
Steve, if people feel, though, that there already is a tool that allows them to delete their search history, that's only a local effect, I'm assuming. In other words, if you go into your history and delete it, that doesn't delete it from Google's servers.
Well, there's some language in their terms of service, their new privacy policy, that says that they may not delete all of your deleted information immediately. Uh-huh. Facebook recently got in trouble for retaining photos for years on their servers after they had been deleted publicly. And those photos were actually accessible to outsiders if you knew the right URL term to put into your browser.
All right, let's go. So, I'd like to move on to Ingrid, who's in Boulder, Colorado. Ingrid, you're on Talk of the Nation. Hi, Ingrid. Hello?
Yes, hi.
Hi, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, yes. I have a situation where Google sort of bullied me into linking what is my work email to my YouTube channel.
How do you mean they bullied
you? Which I had originally set up a Yahoo account.
How did they bully you?
Pardon?
How do you mean, when you say they bullied you, how did they do that?
Oh, like Lori mentioned, I had to create a Gmail account for work. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I did, they automatically linked that to my YouTube channel.
Which was not work-related.
Exactly.
I see. Okay. And the and the consequences of that so far, anything gone wrong, or it's just you don't like the idea of it?
Yeah, I just find it very frustrating because that's personal, not work-related. And the other part of it is that there's no way to contact somebody at Google.
Steve?
I wish I could help you out with that specific technical problem. People at Google have told me that it is possible to create two Google sign-in identities. So it might be possible for you to create a sign-in for your social life and put your YouTube account in that and create it, and separate that from your work account.
Right.
Sorry?
It would have to be another Gmail account, right?
I'm not entirely sure, but if we have time, we could try to ask the official from Google.
Yeah, Ingrid, we're going to be joined in a little while, so keep listening by Keith Enright, who is Senior Privacy Counsel at Google, and we'll ask him that question.
Right, and I would love if you would ask them why you can't connect with a person either by email or phone or any way.
The human interaction. Right. All right, we will ask about that. Thanks very much for calling us, Ingrid. We also are getting a lot of emails from you, and we have one from Charlotte who asks, I do care about Google harvesting more information about what I'm doing, and I'd like to know how can I control it? Simply opt out of Google. Well, opting out of Google entirely, I guess, is an option. Another emailer writes, my solution to Google's increasing snooping into internet use? Simple. I do use Google Search a fair amount, but I pay $15 for a commercial email account, which includes enterprise-level antivirus protection, and I don't log into anything Google. It's interesting, Steve, because I said to Lori, what about just leaving Google Land behind? And she said that that's becoming an increasingly difficult thing, and almost as though it's not voluntary.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you think about all the times you interact with Google products during the day, it can be daunting. But there are some products out there that work well that don't track you. There's a search engine, it's a little search engine called DuckDuckGo that isn't based on tracking and delivering web advertising. So that's an option that's gotten a fair bit of attention recently.
And is DuckDuckGo as satisfying a search engine? Does it produce as well as Google?
You know, I haven't used it nearly as much as Google, but when I have, I've gotten pretty good results.
Okay. You know, we want to bring in now Keith Enright. He is a senior privacy counsel at Google. He's joining us by phone from Mountain View, California. Keith, thanks very much for joining us on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me.
So give us the story. Why was it important to Google to make these changes and to make them now?
Sure. Actually, you know, I appreciate the opportunity to clarify some of the confusion that exists out there right now about the privacy policy changes. Really, I think three key points that are important to get across. First, for your average user that is using Google Search in a non-logged-in state, their experience hasn't changed at all today. They're going to continue using Google in the way that they always have, and the privacy policy updates are not going to impact that.
So if you go to the public library, don't log in, but Google is there, you can use it, and you're not being tracked.
Exactly. There is nothing in the updated privacy policy that will have any impact on that user whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But for those users who, you know, are going to be logging in and using their Google accounts in a logged-in state, there are a couple things that we really wanted to accomplish with the privacy policy updates. First, we wanted to make privacy easier to understand for our users. We wanted to help them understand how we use their information. There are users that are concerned, that want to familiarize themselves with how Google uses their information. Previously, they would have had to review 70 different policies. We've collapsed 60 of those down now into one. We've made it more readable. We've made it more generally accessible. And that was an important goal for us that's consistent with guidance that we've been getting from regulators around the world and from privacy thought leaders. Secondly, we really want to create a seamless experience for users. We want them to have a consistent experience across all the Google products and services with which they choose to engage. And as you guys have already been discussing, I think quite well, this has given us in the past the opportunity to really develop new products and features that delight users.
Mm-hmm.
The ability, for example, to go into Google Maps and to share maps with a group of people from a Google Plus circle without having to individually enter each of those email addresses, it makes that Google product more efficient. It makes it more useful for people. And these are the kinds of things, you know, we're perpetually trying to innovate to make our products and services better. And the ability to freely use the information that users give us to improve the services for those users and allow them to benefit from the use of that data, that's really one of the primary motivations here.
Let me bring to you some of the questions that our listeners have already brought up. And specifically, and it's not strictly on privacy, but we all want to know, why can't we talk to a human being at Google? Why isn't there an 800 Google number that we can call?
Sure. If you look at the scale of the organization, the best way that we can get meaningful information out to users about the questions that they have about our products and services is typically through our online facts. We try to aggregate all of the questions we receive from users and get them meaningful, simple, actionable answers that point them to the right direction. If people do navigate through our frequently asked questions pages in our help center, there are email addresses that they can contact. For privacy questions specifically, that person is in my organization that receives inbound privacy questions and responds to them when they come to them. And then the intelligence that we glean from the kinds of questions that we get is used to improve the help centers and create new frequently asked questions entries so that consumers can self-help, which is usually the fastest way to get an answer to your question.
And Lori Andrews, you heard, raised a number of scenarios that she says are real, things that actually happened, including just for herself, that the linkage between her search account and her YouTube account resulted in advertisements being presented to her while she was watching with her son that she felt were not appropriate for her son to be looking at because of a rather random collection of searches that in a way your algorithm turned into a simple narrative. And it sounds plausible that that sort of thing can happen and that it's unpleasant. What's the protection against that?
So there are a number of protections that immediately present themselves. One is it's important to understand that Google does not use information from sensitive categories like medical conditions to target advertisements to logged-in users. We simply don't do that. In addition to that, we do offer a wide range of privacy controls that really empower the user to control what types of advertising they're going to receive when they're using Google products and services. The centerpiece of those privacy controls is probably the Ads Preferences Manager. Mm-hmm. They can go into the Ads Preferences Manager. They can control which interest categories are associated with them anonymously. They can delete individual interest categories to really control the kind of advertising they're going to see if that's of interest to them, or they can opt out of interest-based advertising altogether. Additionally, you know, some of the other things that you've already talked about, users have a wide range of choices when they're engaging with Google services. Many of our services they can engage with anonymously by not logging into their account. They can still get the value of the service without having it at all personalized. They can log into their account and they can create multiple different accounts. So, for example, Jane at Home and Jane at Work. And you could use the Jane at Home account for all of your personal activity and the Jane at Work account for professional activity. And Google will not link information across those two accounts.
Okay.
Those will remain separate.
Okay. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I want to bring in Peter from Houston, Texas. Peter, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Yeah. Good afternoon. This is a very interesting show. I Googled in my name. Mm-hmm. Just to see what showed up, and it showed up that I had I was looking up various books at Amazon, and I don't think that's anybody's business what I look up in terms of books, but it showed up all my searches from Amazon. How do I get rid of that?
You mean that when you went into the search field and you began typing into Amazon, the previous things that you had searched revealed themselves to you?
Yeah. When I typed in my name, it showed all my Amazon searches on there.
Okay. I'm not quite sure I completely understand, but Keith Enright, do you see the picture there?
Sure. If I'm understanding the question correctly, I would say the way to resolve that would be to log into your Amazon account. And look at what privacy settings Amazon makes available to you. Because if I'm understanding you correctly, it sounds like they're surfacing information about your purchase behavior there that you should have control over. And I imagine you probably can control within the Amazon.com website.
All right. So it sounds as though, Peter, that what you're talking about may be something that's happening at Amazon, not Google.
As opposed to Google?
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a whole nother show. I mean, we'll have to have that one, I think.
Yeah.
But thanks very much, Peter, for joining us.
I just found it very strange that
And it's making you uncomfortable, and I want to bring that back to Keith Enright, and that in general, there just is an uncomfortable feeling that people are getting here when they hear all of this data collected in one place, and all we have to go on in terms of trusting you is trusting you. And what do we do with that?
No, I think it's a fair question, and it's one that we take very, very seriously. User trust is central to Google. What we are more committed to doing than anything is developing products that delight users, that are going to bring them back to Google, that they're going to continue engaging with. If they do that, then we are going to be successful. If we cross any line and we make them uncomfortable, our competition is only one click away. So we need to invest heavily in that trust relationship with consumers. We do things like the various privacy settings that I've already described a little bit. We have data liberation. So if for some reason a consumer isn't entirely comfortable with the terms of our service, don't hold their data hostage.
Keith, I have to break off because we're coming up to our break. I want to thank Keith Enright for joining us from Google and Steve Henn, our technology correspondent from NPR out in Silicon Valley. And this conversation can continue and is already taking place on our website, talk@npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Donovan in Washington.